From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Bonnie Raitt plays us the blues recordings that most influenced her own music. She's up for a Grammy this week. So is her father, John Raitt, a former Broadway star. In addition to hearing the records Bonnie Raitt brought, we'll hear excerpts of her new live CD, Road Tested. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the debut album by the duo Shibo Mato, two Japanese women in Manhattan who he says like to turn cultural cliches inside out. And Steve Weinberg reviews the new Henry Jaglom film, Last Summer at the Hamptons. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Grammy Awards will be presented on Wednesday. My guest Bonnie Raitt is nominated for Best Female Pop Vocal for her rendition of Roy Orbison's You Got It. Her father, John Raitt, the former Broadway star, is nominated for his album Broadway Legend. It's the first time a parent and child have been nominated in the same year in different categories. Bonnie Raitt was queen of the Grammys for a while. She won four of them for her 1989 album Nick of Time and three for her 1991 Luck of the Draw. Bonnie Raitt has a recent live double CD called Road Tested, recorded during her 1995 summer tour. It features duets with some of the singer-songwriters and rhythm and blues performers that have shaped her style. We invited her to play us some of the blues recordings that most influenced her own development as a singer and guitarist. Before we hear them, let's listen to a blues from her first album, which was released in 1971. This is the Robert Johnson song, Walking Blues.
Woke up this morning, I'm feeling around in my shoes. You know by that I must have had them, oh, walking blues. Woke up this morning, people, around my shoes. Well, you know by that I must have had them walking blues.
Bonnie Raitt, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hi, Terry. It's a pleasure to be here.
You've brought with you some of your favorite recordings, some of the recordings that have really influenced you over the years. So I'd like to start with a recording that you brought by Mississippi Fred McDowell. Write me a few lines. Tell me why you've chosen this. This was recorded in 1964.
Well, I did because I've been performing that song, Write Me a Few of Your Lines, as well as his Kokomo Blues, probably since the first time I met Fred. I was about 19 in 1969, and he was part of the great blues rediscovery in the 60s of all these traditional Delta bluesmen who a lot of times, like Fred, had spent the last 20 years being farmers and then suddenly were discovered by either British or white college kids coming over that just fell in love. And I got his record on our Hooli Records and learned the song, and then I was honored enough to meet him and travel around with him. And I actually opened a lot of shows for him early on when I was still cutting my teeth and right before I got my first record deal. So he's really my favorite and my closest friend, and I miss him a lot and wanted people to know that when they hear my version on the live album, for example, that this is where we got it, the great Mississippi Fred McDowell.
Oh, let's hear it, recorded in 1964.
Lord, when you get home, baby, please write me a few of your lines. So now you write me a few of your lines. Lord, that'll be consolation. Lord, mama, to my worried mind.
That's Mississippi Fred McDowell, one of the records that Bunny Raitt has brought with her today for us to listen to. Now, what was it like when you were actually traveling with him and opening for him? Was that one of the first times that you met one of the blues musicians who you liked so much from record?
Actually, I started out with the father of Delta Blues. I'm making an appearance in Cambridge at the house of a man who helped rediscover him, Dick Waterman, who came to be a very important part of my life and a lot of the lives of blues people. Sun House was staying with Dick Waterman in Cambridge, where I was going to college, and I heard through the Harvard radio station that he was going to be there, and this other blues fanatic, a friend of mine, said, would you like to meet him? So it started with that, and then I met Dick Waterman that day and went on to get to hang out with the Skip James and Big Boy Arthur Crudup and Fred McDowell and Mance Lipscomb, and then Buddy Guy Jr. Wells were all people that Dick booked, and he had worked with Mississippi John Hurt, who unfortunately had passed away before I got a chance to meet him. But that was my entry into meeting all these great blues people, and part of the reason I took a semester off in my sophomore year was because I knew that these guys were up in age and that I wasn't going to have this opportunity to kind of get to know them and learn at their feet and be of service or just hang out and get and soak this up. And that was when Fred and I just made this bond, and I'm sure he, as well as the other bluesmen, always got a big kick out of the fact that this little round-faced redhead was playing Robert Johnson songs and Sun House songs, and I just sat there listening to their stories and learned to drink and, you know, try to be a blues woman at 20, which, you know, I managed to do by the time I was 40 and get recognized for it. But, you know, I worked at it pretty hard there in the early days.
Were you overwhelmed when you were 20 by the incredible differences between, you know, in age, race, gender, class, between you and the older blues musicians who you were understudying?
You know, I'm sure it was odd from the outside, but from the inside, most of the people that were in love with blues were white middle-class kids that were just, you know, going to folk festivals and going around the South with tape recorders. And, of course, the British interest in the blues and Big Bill Brunsey and Lead Belly, and that led to so many of these records being exposed to groups that became the Rolling Stones and the Animals and the Beatles even. You know, the rhythm and blues music was on the radio at that time. Not Delta Blues, but Rhythm and Blues was on the radio right next to the Beatles and all the white groups. So it wasn't as segregated, and it didn't seem as culturally odd to me at the time. I just knew that I'd lucked into something.
You know, sometimes when a man is interested in another man's music, that it's understood to be an interest in music, but when a woman is interested in a man's music, it's sometimes understood to be flirtatious or something sexual. Do you know what I mean? Did people ever misunderstand your interest in their music?
No, not really. I mean, Fred at one point was staying overnight at my mom's house. My folks had been divorced at that point, and outside of New York, and I heard him like creeping across the hall in the middle of the night. And I got up and I said, "Hey, Fred, where are you going?" And he said, "Well, you know, I thought your mother might be lonely," which just killed me because I think he thought my mom was really cute. But they never, you know, they never really crossed the boundary. I think the age difference probably made. And my total adoration was more of a daughter thing, I think.
Now, on your latest album, your live album, you do a tribute to Fred McDowell. You play part of Write Me a Few of Your Lines, which we just heard. This is your Kokomo medley. Did you learn things from Fred McDowell on your guitar playing or your approach to that song that you're still using today that you could describe for us?
Well, his particulars, you know, my style's obviously a little different, and of course the key's different because I sing in a woman's key. There were some chords that he used, you know, certain positions on the guitar that I wouldn't have been able to figure out because until I watched him do it. But the basic way you learn guitar for me, because I didn't take lessons, was just listening and mimicking. And his soulfulness on and just his abandon, the way he got into it. And when he played electric guitar, which he did a lot of the time in later years because it cut through more to clubs where kids were noisy. And, you know, that's what led me to the electric guitar, was the way that the note would sustain and just sing, and the way you could just, it's so funky when you get these, you know, cheap amps, and, you know, it's just, you know, that's the stuff that makes David Lindley and Ry Cooder Jackson Browne's slide plan so great because they just use these really incredible amplification that duplicates the old, really inexpensive amps. And people want to know how to get that funky sound. Well, get a $25 guitar and the cheapest amp you can find.
Well, let's hear your tribute to Fred McDowell, the Kokomo medley from your latest album, Road Tested. Bonnie Raitt. Bonnie Raitt is my guest. Now, did he show you that opening riff?
No, I just heard it. You know, it's not that difficult to play. It's just one of the, whenever you're learning a song from somebody else, you don't really have to see it because you can just, unless you're playing some kind of amazing Jimi Hendrix thing, and which I probably wouldn't even be able to tackle. These things that I play are really stuff that I can manage. It's the finesse of it and the soul that you put into it that makes him different from me, probably. And hopefully one day I'll get to be as funky as he is.
Now, I know when you were starting out, you were listening to folk music as well as to blues. Now, women's voices in folk music at the time were kind of like clear, bell-like soprano voices. I'm thinking of, you know, Joan Baez, Judy Collins. Mm. And in blues, of course, it's a much kind of rougher voice that blues singers use. And I was wondering if you have a beautiful, clear voice. I was wondering if you try to also develop a gruffer voice for the blues.
Oh, yeah. Singer. I mean, I thought if I just drank Jim Beam and hung out with those guys and stayed up too late. And I couldn't stand the way I sounded when I was singing blues tunes. It just sounded the fruitiest, you know, whitest voice I'd ever heard, which I didn't mind singing Joan Baez songs. But, and I really did think that if I just lived that, you know, I went from being pretty much not a rebel rouser as a teenager. I was a really good student. I went away to a Quaker school and went right to college, and I don't even think I partied at all until I was about 20, and the drinking age in Massachusetts wasn't even until 21. So I started hanging out with these hardcore guys, and, you know, like any kid sitting at the feet of the masters, you know, I also got to go on tour hanging out with Buddy and Junior's band on the Rolling Stones tour of Europe, so that was some professional hound dogs there. So, you know, those first few years, it was very difficult to be as light sounding as I was. And so I kind of made up for it by bravado and kind of swaggering around thinking I could be, you know, like Etta James in a minute.
You know, when you started on the road and you were opening for a lot of older blues performers, you said that you had to kind of care for the alcohol for them, make sure they drank enough to get on stage, but not too much.
yeah, that was an interesting position to be in. I'm sorry, I cut you off, Terry. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask you about that period and what it was like to realize that with some of the musicians they needed to drink, but you had to make sure they didn't drink too much.
Oh, that was just, yeah, there was one blues festival where it was kind of my job to, because there was a lot of different blues men in one backstage area, all of whom had not only different tastes in what to drink, but could handle it differently. For example, Sunhouse, if he had a couple of shots of vodka, he could remember all of his songs, and if he had too much, he couldn't remember them. So if he didn't have any at all, he usually didn't even want to play. So it was just one of these chemistry experiments that was kind of a funny anecdote for a young college student hanging out with these blues guys, because it was kind of my job to help road manage. And I had to be sure not to let somebody pass a pint bottle to somebody that I knew was just going to get totally toasted. And he didn't play until 4 hours from now. You know, you're getting old guys that have been farmers and Pullman porters for 25 years, and suddenly everybody wants to give them anything they want and whatever quantity, and it did a lot of them in. You know, you have to be really careful, otherwise it's not helping anybody to give somebody who has a propensity to alcoholism too much alcohol. And we've all seen that in every lifestyle in rock and roll.
My guest is Bonnie Raitt. Her latest CD is called Road Tested. We'll talk more and hear more music after a break. This is Fresh Air. Bonnie Raitt is my guest. She's up for a Grammy. And we've asked her to bring with her some of the records that have influenced her over the years. And Bonnie Raitt, the next record you brought with you is by Sippy Wallace. And your fans all know that you've recorded a couple of her songs. You Gotta Know How, Women Be Wise. Tell us about the record you've brought with you and why you've chosen it.
Well, this particular album, which has now been re-released on Alligator Records, it's from an album called, I think it's Sippy Sings the Blues, if they left the name the same. And I picked it up when I was 18. I spent the summer, my freshman year, in on a college charter flight and traveled around Europe with a couple of girlfriends. Went into the famous Dobell's record store in London and found this incredible picture of this woman in these rhinestone cat glasses, and it said Sippy Wallace, and I recognized the name from my old classic blues collection records, compilations, and I'd always really liked Sippy's music because she really didn't take any slack, she didn't cut anybody any slack in terms of men at the time. She wasn't a victim. She was, if you can make me do what you want to do, but you got to know how. And so I had bought the record, fell in love with her, had no idea she was still alive. And at that point, the record was only 2 or 3 years old, I think. And I recorded a couple of her songs, three actually, over my first two albums. And when I was invited to come to the Ann Arbor Blues and Jazz Festival in 1972 to perform, I, at that point, had found out that that's where she was living, in Detroit, and invited her to come out on stage. She said she would only do gospel because she was recovering from a stroke and had given up the blues and was playing in the church. And so I started playing Women Be Wise in the little trailer backstage, and she started kind of sashing back and forth, and she said, well, maybe I'll just do one blues, And the rest is kind of history, because after that, she was the big hit of the festival, our duet of this song, and we went on to record it together in her subsequent album, Sippy, on Atlantic Records. And we toured together for the next 15 years till she passed away at 86.
Well, why don't we hear that 1966 recording that you brought with you, this is re-released on Alligator Records. Sippy Wallace.
Now, women be wise, keep your mouth shut, don't advertise your man, don't ever sit around gossiping, explaining what your good man really can do. Now these women nowadays, they ain't no good. They laugh in your face, then try to steal your man from you. Now women be wise, keep your mouth shut, and don't advertise your man. Don't be no fool, don't advertise.
Man, oh man.
That's a wonderful
That's
recording.
Really, really great. Yeah. It just makes me smile so much to hear this again.
Did Sippy Wallace give you any interesting advice about life or music?
Well, I'd say those lyrics, for starters, I mean, both You Got to Know How and Women Be Wise and Mighty Tight Woman, they're all these tunes that she writes are real lessons, and I learned a lot about what kind of songs appeal to me by what she chose to write about. And, just in terms of her love of family and her independence from men, I mean, she lost her husband many years previous to when I met her and seemed to have a very full life not being somebody's wife. I'm sure she would have, she missed her husband. He was the love of her life, and she really had no desire to get connected again. And that was a very strong lesson to me as a young girl. She was a great... she had some grandnieces, that she took care of, and she raised them by herself, and was just very strong, very independent, and ahead of her time in terms of her just being suspicious and distrustful unless you were proven to be somebody that was worth hanging out with. And that's something that was very important to me, because I did grow up in a feminist era, and to have a blues woman or someone like Ruth Brown or Aretha Franklin as my role models, as well as Joan Baez and Joni Mitchell. These are women that just stood up for themselves and demanded respect.
Bonnie Raitt is my guest, and we've asked her to bring with her some of her favorite recordings from the past, recordings that have really influenced her over the years. And Bonnie Raitt, the next recording that you brought with you is B.B. King, and this one goes back to 1958. Rock Me Baby, tell me why you chose this one.
Well, this is one of the greatest vocals I've ever heard, and so simple, and the piano part and the arrangement. This is really early in, even though B.B. started in the late 40s, and it's got a lot of his hits in the 50s, this was a record that when I was 10 or 11 years old, I happened to hear on a radio station, and later just was my, everybody's got that one record that just turned their head around. I mean, sometimes there's a Ray Charles tune that did it for me, and then later hearing John Lee Hooker when I was about 14. But B.B. King was a big star in Los Angeles on the black radio, and Rock Me Baby's just a classic tune. I mean, many people have covered it, but I just wanted to bring it to let you know how unbelievably simple and pure and right to the bone this song can be. And B.B. is still one of our greatest bluesmen, and I love him dearly.
Let's hear it. Rock Me Baby, B.B. King, recorded in 1958 and reissued on the B.B. King box set.
Rock me, baby, rock me all night long.
Bonnie Raitt, do you think that there's a specific influence B.B. King has had on your singing or guitar playing?
Well, I sure hope so. I don't know how to play single-string lead on an electric guitar as well as any of the guitar players that are currently out there. I play acoustic solos more, and I play pretty good rhythm guitar, but my lead playing tends to remain on the slide guitar where I know what I'm doing better. So it probably has more to do with phrasing and what to leave out, and just, when you go crazy for somebody's style, it's not, unless you're doing a specific mimicking of what they're doing, which I don't do, it's just hard to say. It would be for the outsider to say, I think she was influenced by this person more than that person. But for me, I would say my singing, just because of his restraint and his passion, I hope I got some influence from him, because I just think he's one of the tastiest and most deep singers I've ever heard, as well as one of the greatest blues guitar players alive in the history of guitar players.
Bonnie Raitt, her latest album is called Road Tested. She'll be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Bonnie Raitt, playing some of the recordings that most influenced her own music. A little later, we'll hear music from her latest CD, a live album called Road Tested. Well, the next record you've brought with you is a departure from what we've been hearing. We've been hearing blues performers. We've got reggae up next, Toots and the Maytals. Tell us about the song that you've selected and why you've chosen it.
True Love is Hard to Find is a great tune, just universal appeal that I ended up recording on my Nine Lives album, which about three people probably know about. It was after I'd been dropped from Warner's, and then nobody else would buy the tapes, not because they weren't good from my next album, but because the price was too high. Warner's was trying to make some money back on it. And then after a few years, they said, oh, we're sorry, we will put out your 1983 Tongue and Groove record. And I said, no, you don't, because it's old by now. I've already played these songs, and you're going to have to let me put some new stuff on there. And so to make a long story short, we did a half and half record, and I called it Nine Lives because basically, you know, you can kill a cat nine times and they still get up, and it was my ninth album, so it was a little tongue-in-cheek comment on that. And True Love is Hard to Find, I got Sippy Wallace to come and sing the tag on my version, and I, at that point, had met Toots Hibbert, who's just one of my absolute heroes, one of the greatest reggae and soul singers in the world, and there's an era of reggae from the Wailers and Bob Marley's early days, and The Harder They Come soundtrack was, and the movie was very big in Cambridge during my college years and in the early 70s, and that influenced me a lot and turned me on to reggae, and the group Orleans was doing a lot of reggae music and spending a lot of time down in that part of the Caribbean on their off months. So I really just have always loved reggae, and this is my favorite tune. I mean, since I was asked to narrow them down, I wanted to bring my absolute favorite by Toots and the Maytals.
Okay, recorded in 1976, True Love is Hard to Find.
You say that your love was just for me, and that's right, I've got to be yours. You told me that a day will never come when you will walk out on me, God, you know that.
Bonnie Raitt is my guest, and we've asked her to bring some of her favorite recordings. And Bonnie Raitt, you know, since you've recorded this yourself, let's play the end of your version, in which Sippy Wallace comes in and sings with you. Tell us about this.
Well, it was really something to get this woman in her mid-80s to come out and record a reggae song, which I'm sure she had never heard that beat before. And she also really wasn't used to headphones at all and didn't understand the fact that you could overdub, you know, like she couldn't figure out why the musicians weren't in the room at the same time. And so we went over and over, because I had done a recording with her, but it was all live. And of course, she hadn't done a recording in the studio ever with overdubs. So I sort of tried to tell her, it was almost like jumping rope, you know, trying to tell somebody when to jump. And she listened to the song, and she's like nodding, you know, and I wished I had a camera. And then she just made up stuff to say. She said, you know, and you'll be able to hear her saying, you know, sometimes a good man is, you know, it's so hard to find a good man, or yes, it's true love is very hard to find. I mean, she's just got her own little scat singing at the end there that just kills us. So it's one of my favorite memories.
Yeah, let's hear it.
True love is hard to find.
Bonnie Raitt is my guest, and she's brought with her some of her favorite records. And Bonnie Raitt, I want to ask you about a couple of records that are nominated for Grammys. And there's a record of yours and a record of your father's. Now, this is apparently Grammy news. I think it's history-making that a father and daughter are both nominated in separate categories, of course, for a Grammy Award. You're actually on your father's CD. And your father is, of course, John Raitt, who starred in many Broadway musicals and movie musicals as well. And I'm sure you grew up listening to a lot of Broadway songs, though that's not what we associate with you with. And yet you do sing a couple on your father's CD. So before we hear you and him duetting, I'm interested if it took you a long time in your career to feel comfortable recording something like this. Recording outside of the genre that you're known for.
Yeah, it took a lot. It took a long time to summon up the nerve, and I think somewhat of maturity and sobriety had something to do with it. What comes with sobriety in terms of being able to have a perspective, and since that coincided with my late 30s, early 40s for me, it's hard to separate the two. I think that a great song has appealed to me, and I've been in love with the songs of Carousel in Oklahoma and Pajama Game since my dad has been singing them all my life. I just never really thought I would sing them in public. I certainly sung them enough in private just for fun and grew up singing them. We started this idea out when we used to just practice Christmas carols and would sing different Broadway songs in his pool. We'd be exercising together, and that was a good way to spend some father-daughter alone time. And next thing I knew, he sort of suggested doing something together, maybe for the Pops. And before we knew it, we were performing with John Williams for Evening at the Pops a few years ago. And we did these songs that we ended up putting on my dad's album. And I enjoyed it so much and was terrified to sing in front of an orchestra in a town in Boston that is like I got my start in. And I think the fact that it was a safe ground made it an easy first date. And we went on to do David Letterman together, and he's been coming out over the many years and singing Oklahoma at the end of my shows. But I must say I was shivering in my boots the first time I sang They Say That Falling in Love is Wonderful in front of my audience. But they, stood up and cheered, and that gave me the confidence to put it on a record.
Okay, well, from the album John Raitt, Broadway Legend, let's hear Bonnie Raitt and her father singing Hey There from the Pajama Game.
Hey there, you with the stars in your eyes. Love never made a fool of you. You used to be
in the air.
She has you dancing on a string.
A puppet on a string.
Break it and she won't care.
She won't care for me.
Won't you take this advice I hand you like a brother?
Or am I not seeing things too clear?
Are you too much in love to hear?
Is it all going in one ear and out the other?
Bonnie Raitt and her father, John Raitt. Bonnie Raitt, when you started singing blues and you were hanging out with older blues musicians, did they know who John Raitt was? Did they know from Oklahoma and the Pajama Game?
I don't think they did, because he was only in the film of The Pajama Game, and Gordon McRae was already under contract with the studio that bought the rights. So they, you know, it was one of those things where Julie Andrews did My Fair Lady on Broadway and was the big hit, and Audrey Hepburn got the movie part. Well, my dad did Oklahoma, and, you know, on Broadway he did Carousel, and then Gordon McRae did the movie. So I think they probably weren't familiar just because of that cultural change. But once they met me, I think they soon after met my dad, because we would do so many gigs together and he would come and visit and sometimes would sing Oklahoma, and they were just knocked out by him.
They'd sing, like Fred McDowell would hear your father singing Oklahoma?
I think Fred probably missed out on that because he passed away in 72. But by the time I got a band after my third album, my dad was on tour all the time himself, and occasionally our tour buses would cross, and we'd jam together in one city, as it were, you know, if you can call it singing Oklahoma, jamming. And sometimes Buddy Guy and Junior Wells would be on the show with us, and they got to see it, and I think maybe Muddy Waters as well.
My guest is Bonnie Raitt. We'll talk more and hear more music after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Bonnie Raitt. As we can tell from the records you've brought with you today, you really like to acknowledge your debt to your predecessors in blues. And you've done that not only through recording their songs, but for the people who were alive, you really did your best to call attention to them and introduce them to your listeners when you became popular. And now you're very active in something called the Rhythm and Blues Foundation. Tell us a little bit about the goals of the foundation and why that's so important to you.
The R&B Foundation is a group of us that were very concerned about the lack of royalty payments and fairness from rhythm and blues artists. And it was founded about 7 years ago in Washington, D.C., by a lawyer named Howell Beagle, who had basically gone to Atlantic Records to try to get clarification on some royalty statements for about 35 of the great R&B artists, like Ruth Brown and the Clovers, different acts. And it came to pass that all of us were horrified to find out that people before 1970 basically did not get our current 10% standard royalty rate, but something very little, if a royalty at all, and out of which they were supposed to pay the entire cost of every album. And so we have all these great rhythm and blues artists, and it's also country acts and pop acts as well, who did not participate in their own profits and therefore didn't belong to the union all this time, didn't get union coverage, and don't have any health benefits. So the foundation was formed with an endowment out of which we give Pioneer Awards every year, which is, you know, 20,000 to 8 or 9 different wonderful pioneers of rhythm and blues, and 4 groups that split 20,000. And we give a Lifetime Achievement Award. We've had 7 annual Pioneer Awards, and this year will be the 29th of February, and Bo Diddley is receiving the Lifetime Achievement Award. And we've honored over 100 different recipients, but the basic thrust of the organization is to get royalty reform from different record companies, to ask them to wipe out the past debts, and if you're going to sell records today and CDs by these artists, give them the standard rate. And in the 7 years, we've managed to get that from EMI, from Atlantic Records. We're working on Warner Brothers, working on MCA has agreed to come around, and PolyGram is still a holdout, and Sony has just last year agreed to come on board. So basically, we're trying to get financial and medical assistance and eventually get some health insurance, because this is not an issue of charity. This is an issue of justice and money that they should have been making all this time, but the contracts of the day just weren't that fair.
So the main purpose of the Rhythm and Blues Foundation is to help artists get royalties that they're owed, and also help them with health benefits and with money if they've been deprived of royalties.
Yeah, and we're also trying to get some performance opportunities. You know, it's like things like having
to revive careers.
Yeah, and like, you know, there's a lot of cities that have blues festivals now, but what about if the, you know, the assemblies and the, I was talking to somebody the other day that said that this black jazz musician went into a predominantly urban Latino and black high school the other day at an assembly and was talking, giving a lecture, and he asked the kids, how many of you have heard of Duke Ellington? And one kid out of 200 raised his hand. So, you know, the fact that these artists could be going into the schools and giving performances and letting especially young black kids know where this music comes from, because, you know, Prince is not the godfather of soul, you know what I mean? And we got to do something to change that, because there would be no Eric Clapton or Rod Stewart or Bonnie Raitt or Stevie Ray Vaughan without the artists that started this, and they didn't get what was due for them.
Well, I want to end with something from your Road-Tested album, and this is I Can't Make You Love Me. It's a really beautiful ballad, very moving. Is this a favorite of yours, too?
Yeah, I'd have to say that of all the tunes I've recorded, this one moves me the most, and it's the one that gets mentioned to me when I'm out and about, and, you know, sky caps or people that are taking my reservation on the phone, you know, they just have spoken to me about how much that song means, and I just have to thank Mike Reed and Alan Shamlin for feeling as deeply as they did to come up with this, because I definitely think this is one that's going to stand the test of time.
Turn down the lights, turn down the bed, turn down these voices inside my head. Lay down with me and tell me no lies, just hold me close. Don't patronize, don't patronize me, 'cause I can make you love me if you don't. You can make your heart feel something it won't.
Bonnie Raitt with Bruce Hornsby at the piano from her live double CD, Road Tested. She's up for a Grammy on Wednesday. On Thursday, the Rhythm and Blues Foundation, which she co-founded, will present its Pioneer Awards. Film critic Steve Weinberg has a review of Henry Jaglom's latest film, Last Summer at the Hamptons. It's a theatrical parody, a sex farce, and a tribute to Anton Chekhov. It takes place on an East Hampton estate where a family of show people gather to summer and perform.
A lot of art house mavens who find Woody Allen too slick tend to be impressed by the films of Henry Jaglom, who made, among many others, Someone to Love, Eating, and the new Last Summer at the Hamptons. Jaglom goes in for the same kind of neurotic house party atmosphere as Allen, but he incorporates improvisation, and his fans love the low-key intimacy of his comedies. Non-enthusiasts like me tend to think the reason Jaglom's pictures feel more handmade than Woody Allen's is that he lacks basic filmmaking skills. He doesn't know how to stage a scene, where to put the camera, or how long to leave it there. In Jaglom's world, editing still hasn't been invented. He lingers over his actors as if he couldn't get enough of them, which usually means we get too much. However, in Last Summer at the Hamptons, some of the performers offer genuine compensation for the long hour and three quarters the film asks us to surrender. The setting is East Hampton, Long Island, where a theatrical family gathers for the final weekend of their final season in a beloved house. It's been sold, like the cherry orchard. That's only the first of many Chekhov echoes. While these summer people put the finishing touches on their annual production, The Seagull, naturally, they keep an eye on their careers while putting the moves on each other. The successful gay playwright, John Robin Bates, plays a successful gay playwright. whose new script excites the ambitions of his actor uncle, a hunky acting student, a visiting Hollywood star, and even his grandmother, an acting coach and retired actress who presides over the vanishing estate. The large cast of characters also includes the playwright's philandering director father, his actress sister, who tends to fall for the same guys he does, and another uncle who sleeps with a movie star. I find Bates's own plays strident, so his understatement and comic ease in the role of the playwright took me by surprise. He's especially good in his scenes with Nick Gregory as the student, who turns a come-on into a deftly sustained gag before he eventually reveals what he's really after, the plum role in Bates's play.
I wanted to talk to you about Angelo.
Uh-huh.
I really relate to the character a lot. I think,
Yes?
I feel he's very misunderstood.
Uh-huh.
And I think a lot of people misunderstand me.
What are you doing?
What?
How do people misunderstand you?
I don't know, you know, I mean...
You're a lot more sensitive than people think.
Yeah.
You're misunderstood.
Yeah.
For instance, if people think that you're an opportunistic little hustler, they're misinterpreting you.
Exactly.
What's this number right here, huh? What's this shirtless, tan, standing in front of me number? I mean, you're not gay. Let's get that right out. So don't take advantage of me, okay? I've been there and I despise it.
The part of the satyr-like director, who rehearses his shows for years, gives Andre Gregory, Nick's real-life father, the opportunity for some superbly judged self-parody. Brooke Smith, the peerless Sonia of Gregory's and Louis Malle's Vanya on 42nd Street, has only a tiny role, but you get delectable glimpses of her as Nina in The Seagull. These four actors make up for a lot of nonsense, like that old faker Vivica Lindfors devouring the role of the matriarch as if she were playing Norma Desmond, and as the Hollywood celebrity Victoria Foyt, who co-wrote the script with Jaglom, imitating various jungle animals. A friend confided that she ducked into the lobby whenever Bates or Smith or one of the Gregorys wasn't on screen. That may be the best scheme for watching last summer at the Hamptons.
Steve Einberg writes for the Boston Phoenix and teaches at College of the Holy Cross. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews an amusing new CD. This is Fresh Air. Rock critic Ken Tucker has heard a new CD that he says is one of the most interesting and amusing new releases of the year. It's the debut album of the duo Shibo Mato. The group is made up of two Japanese women from the Lower East Side of Manhattan. Miho Hattori sings, Yuka Honda creates the sounds behind the vocal. Their album is called Viva La Woman.
16 years ago one day, I was walking down the street. I was cruising in Brooklyn, you know what I mean? Was cooking, but was it the chicken? There was a man selling chicks in a box. Said 2 for 1, but 2 for 2. I said, that's no bad, here's money for you. What was the magenta? The other was the blue.
I know my chicken. You got to know you're a chicken. I know my chicken. You got to know you're a chicken.
Every one of the 10 cuts on Viva La Woman is about food, which makes a certain amount of sense, given that Cibo Mato is pidgin Italian for food madness or crazy food. Miho Hattori and Yuka Honda talk about drinking sugar water, about licking white pepper ice cream, about eating beef jerky. They cover the Sammy Davis Jr. hit, The Candyman. And when they want to wax poetic, they say, "My heart is like an artichoke. I eat the petals myself one by one." On another song, they yell, "Extra sugar, extra salt, extra oil, and MSG." And when they say, "Shut up and eat," what they really mean is, "Be quiet and listen."
My weight is 300 pounds. My favorite is beef jerky. I'm a vagabond. I'm a vagabond. My mom says you are kinky. Who cares? I don't care. I hope she lasts even better than yours. Who cares? I don't care. I hope she lasts even better than yours. Who cares? I don't care. I hope she lasts even better than yours. Who cares? I don't care. I hope she lasts even better than yours.
When Chibo Matto talk about food, they are, as you may have guessed, also talking about sex, about love, about art. The lyrics are intentionally oblique, fractured, making allusions that are surreally obscure. Among the many witty things this duo does is play upon the idea that when we hear an accent, we frequently assume that the person speaking doesn't understand English as well as we do, that naive, elementary grammatical mistakes will be made. But Chibo Matto knows exactly what they're doing, turning all sorts of cultural cliches inside out.
Yes! Mom, isn't it? I don't give a flying fuck about.
The music on Viva La Woman combines chunks of original music with samples from other people's songs and a riot of sound effects. Miho's voice floats serenely above the chaos. The result is a wonderfully organized messiness. What I like most about Chibo Matto is that everything they do contains elements of irony, camp, and distance, yet what comes out is very direct and emotional. Their ambition seems to be nothing less than to swallow pop music whole.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Viva La Woman by the duo Chibo Matto. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Chris Fraley, Al Banks, Joyce Lieberman, and Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shirok directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publishers of We're Right, They're Wrong, a handbook for spirited progressives by James Carville. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.